Hello, it is Sunday, March 17th, and this is episode 11 of the Defensive Security Podcast. My name is Jerry Bell. As usual, the thoughts and opinions I express on this podcast are mine and do not represent those of my employer. Well, all right, I'm all liquored up and ready to get going with this week's news. The first thing, actually, something that's absent this week is a Java Zero Day. There's no new ones to report, which I think is the first time this year, if I'm not mistaken. That's not saying that there aren't Java Zero Days out there that haven't been patched yet, but no new ones this week. I'm sure people are working on that for next week. All right, the first story. I think unless you've been living under a rock or not paying attention to Twitter, you are probably aware that Brian Krebs got swatted due to some reporting he was doing a couple days ago. Brian's site was being denial of service. He received a fake FBI notice from his ISP that was forwarded to them by someone trying to take his site down for participating in criminal activity. Fortunately, his ISP recognized that it was BS and didn't take any action. Later that day, the local police department showed up in force and, of course, caused Brian to have a bad day. Apparently, somebody called 911 from Brian's cell phone number, or at least spoofed his cell phone number, and told the dispatcher that some Russians had broken into his house and shot his wife. Swatting's been a pretty disturbing trend. I suspect some people think it's a little humorous when it happens to celebrities they love to hate, but the reality is it's pretty dangerous. And I hope, possibly, maybe, this might be an impetus for infrastructure companies and telcos to start putting some verification, validation, authentication, whatever you want to call it, behind the 911 service. Relying on caller ID seems pretty archaic, given how easy it is to spoof caller ID numbers. In another bit of news, the National Vulnerability Database was taken offline, along with a number of other sites, after two web servers running those sites were found to have some malware and some firewall logs tipped off the administrators that something was going on, and they were taken offline and found to have been compromised with some malware by a Cold Fusion Zero Day that apparently hadn't been patched. Sounds like the sites have been infected potentially for a couple of months. Allegedly, there's no indication that they were being used to host malware like some of the other sites, like NBC and others. However, I think they were down for quite a while, although I checked this morning and they are indeed back up. But you can kind of see how a relatively authoritative site like the National Vulnerability Database, run by a government entity, could potentially be used as a watering hole attack against unsuspecting victims. It also says that you really have to have layers of security proactively looking for evidence that your systems are compromised. So in this case, apparently it took a while, but eventually they did indeed see some evidence that these sites were compromised. All right, the next story is something that I don't often talk about, which is politics. And given some of the outgrowth of the Mandiant report and obviously things that are just generally happening in the industry, there's a bit of a war of words happening between the U.S. and China. China certainly reacted badly to the report for Mandiant, and there's been a kind of a back and forth spat lately. Interesting development this week is that China offered, apparently again, to talk with the U.S. about implementing some kind of, quote, cybersecurity baseline security standards. This is interesting because actually Russia and China have been trying to get the U.S. to do this for quite some time. and the U.S. has not been a willing participant. And actually, for a good reason. China and Russia are very interested in doing this because they want to implement some fairly strict online security controls, which are viewed by many to be a means of cracking down on their population or censoring their population, monitoring for dissidents, that sort of thing. So the U.S. hasn't been a big fan of that, but likely the U.S. will end up having some kind of talks with China about this. I really can't see anything coming out of this having a lot of teeth, just given the dynamics between China and the U.S., you know, given that we have such a very strong industrial and business relationship with China, and China conversely owns so much U.S. debt. It just seems to me like it's a bit of a paper tiger, and China's really in the driver's seat here. In the show notes, I linked to a fairly interesting article from Slate about this situation and their take on the dynamics, which basically I largely agree with. Well, next story, in the world of malware, there's a new exploit kit running around these days called Neutrino. And Neutrino has been found on the internet exploiting a couple of Java Zero days. And after it exploits a system, it drops some ransomware, which does all the normal things you would expect ransomware to do, making systems unusable or encrypting files, and demanding a payment to unlock them. Trend Micro is saying that hacking forums are offering Neutrino for rent for $40 a day or $450 a month. And given that apparently some people have made a couple hundred thousand dollars, that's not a bad deal. This particular kit does a couple of interesting things. It drops the package onto a system and encrypts it and renames the file to make it look like Skype. There's a lot of effort being put into this to avoid detection by antivirus. And of course, once it's on, it infects the system and locks out the user, basically telling them that the computer has a virus, and in order to regain control, they need to pay some money, and they give instructions on how to pay the bad guys. So yet more reason to be wary about browsing around on the internet. All right, next story in malware is a new version of Zeus is being distributed. This has a couple of new features, such as that it encrypts communication between the CNC servers and the bots. It uses the domain generation algorithm type of model. There's been quite a lot written about DGA last year, but I think now we're really starting to see that concept hit the mainstream as a method to make sure command and control infrastructures can remain in place and are a lot harder to take down. Zeus can now drop some third-party malware, which honestly I thought it already had the ability to do, but apparently this is something new. This new version also allows the botmaster to specify custom check-in intervals, and I suspect that has a lot to do with trying to evade detection. And the last new feature is that it allows botmasters to hide files and to inject DLLs and make some other changes to the registry. I suspect a lot of this is in the name of maintaining persistence, so that even if the bot is detected and cleaned, there are other components that might still reside and allow access to the infected system. And, you know, really, that's yet one more reason that if a system gets compromised, and by compromised, I don't mean just someone has a shell on your system. I mean, it has malware on it. You really need to rebuild it. You need to reinstall the OS from known good media and start over. It's painful, but the attackers are getting ever more clever. And, you know, look, we know antivirus is not very capable of detecting a lot of viruses. And so if you've got any kind of sophisticated attacker, and I don't mean APT style sophisticated, I mean somebody's pushed a Zeus bot onto your system and they've pushed some mechanism for persistence that isn't detected, you know, at some point in the future you detect Zeus, you get it cleaned off, you're not detecting that other component. I've had to help some organizations in the past make some really painful decisions about this. And it is painful. You know, if you have hundreds or thousands of PCs infected in some kind of a mass outbreak, clearly you need to do some kind of triage to take a look at what was the nature of the infection. But for the most part, you have to do the quote nuke and pave. It's unpleasant. It's very costly. It makes your employees upset, and that's certainly understandable. But you know, otherwise, you really have no good guarantee that you've actually cleaned out the infection. And the tough part really comes when you start trying to evaluate what kind of data can be restored. And I don't think there's really great guidance that applies to everyone other than, you know, you've got to take a look at your specific environment, the specific situation, and make the best call you can. You know, this is why incident response and forensics people make big bucks. This is not easy. If it were easy, we wouldn't have jobs. I think it's pretty cute that the EULA for this new variant of Zeus actually indicates that it's only for educational purposes, as if that will indemnify them when and if someone catches up with them. Well, the other interesting thing about it, this is that apparently there's now a marketplace for Zeus plugins. The article I'm reading says there is a DDoS module, a hosts file modification module, a Black Connect host module, which allows cyber criminals to connect and abuse hosts behind NAT, and a module to convert malware-infected hosts into an asynchronous proxy. And those modules run from between $50 and $380. Well, continuing on with the theme of malware, there's a new variant of the Remnant Trojan. Now, Remnant's been around for a couple of years now. I think it was first seen in 2010 or so, and it really focuses on stealing credentials to websites and bank accounts. But it has lately been seen doing more broad credential stealing for email and corporate VPN connections and that sort of thing. I suspect the market for those sorts of things are starting to grow. And so we're seeing these malware authors basically being opportunistic and going after things that they can monetize. So in the latest version of Remnant, apparently the actual infection agent has been removed, and so now it's going to rely probably on some other type of dropper, like an exploit kit, a cool, a black hole, a neutrino, something like that. And of course the reason they do that is to make it harder to detect with antivirus. And speaking of antivirus, after Remnant's on the system, it collects a list of antivirus engines from its command and control host and then attempts to locate and shut down any processes that are fed to it from its command and control. Now, possibly one of the more interesting things to me with Remnant is that it now includes a troubleshooting module. So it is proactively detecting any of its modules crashing. And if there are crashes, logs are captured and sent up to the command and control host so that the authors can do some debugging. Apparently, quality control is even making a splash in the world of virus writers. It makes me wonder how long we will have to wait until we start seeing patches being pushed and 0 days being announced for some of these pieces of malware. So another interesting component to Ramnet is that it encrypts its payload and its modules on disk using RC4. And it does this so that it's very difficult for antivirus to detect. So, you know, there's presumably some random string generated using different parameters about the host, and then that string comprises a encryption key. The modules and data are written to disk, encrypted using RC4 with that encryption key. When it runs, it reads that data off the disk and decrypts it in memory. And as we all know, antivirus generally doesn't work very well for memory resident things. All right, another story somewhat related to malware and botnets. In India last week, at the NullCon conference in Goa, the Indian government offered a bounty for anyone to take down a botnet that was seen infecting a number of Indian government systems, and the prize amounted to about $600. Needless to say, the botnet actually was taken down pretty quickly, but there has been a lot of debate in the wake of this in the security community. So basically, the concept of vigilantism, or bringing the concept of a bounty hunter into the digital world. Now, there's a lot of arguments for and against, which are pretty sound, and certainly a lot of the ones against tend to be legal based and focused on the principle of avoiding interacting or potentially interfering with the operations of a computer that you don't have explicit permission to be using. So basically, the good guy becomes the bad guy because he's inadvertently hacking either an innocent bystander system or the actual bad system. It's still technically a violation of the law in most jurisdictions. On the pro side, apparently the Indian government had been wrestling with this thing for a while, and it took them about $600 to resolve the problem. So that seems like a fairly good deal. You know, in my view, it's not a bad idea if the right kinds of boundaries can be drawn around it. We kind of see this happening with Microsoft and Kelios, and we saw CrowdStrike take down a botnet at RSA, in fact. So we know that it can happen. Certainly, I think in those cases, it has happened in conjunction with law enforcement. But there isn't necessarily a reason why some kind of framework could be established to do that. We see it in other cases in the physical world, like with Florida and their bounty on pythons in the Everglades. You know, they've got a real problem down there, so they're offering a couple hundred dollars per snake that you bring in. We certainly have bounty hunters that chase down people who have skipped bail. Conceivably, a similar type of construct could be arranged. And I think there are equivalent concerns in the physical world with these bounty type programs that there are in the digital world. So for instance, if you're off hunting a python and you end up shooting someone or damaging someone's property, I don't think the fact that you're off on a bounty excursion excuses you from liability there. And the same thing is if you're a bounty hunter hunting a person and you end up hurting or killing some unrelated person, I suspect you are at very least civilly liable for that. But any damage that you do to the actual intended target is generally too bad, so sad for them. So again, $600 for the Indian government to get rid of a botnet that's been plaguing them seems like a pretty good investment to me. Botnets are becoming an increasingly large problem, as I talk a lot about on this podcast, and there really isn't any organized effort to stop them, other than when we, for instance, have Microsoft get lucky and go after one of them and find a way to shut them down. But my feeling is if we don't really get aggressive on this, it's definitely going to get ahead of us, and we will be living in a fairly crime-ridden neighborhood on the internet, which I realize we probably think we already are, but it's likely to get much, much worse. Certainly, there's other ways to skin the cat. Government agencies could clearly step up and do this too. But, you know, especially in the case of India, they apparently didn't have the sophistication, the tools, the know-how, what have you, to get the job done. So maybe this becomes an imperative for them. Maybe the cybersecurity order that was declared a couple of weeks ago here in the U.S. will eventually direct something like this. But, boy, hard to say. Something's got to change, though. All right, next story is that Mandiant released their 2013 threat report. And there's a lot of good stuff in here. It's tangential, I would say, to the APT1 report that came out about a month ago. You know, there is a section dedicated to that, which in my view is kind of a rehash of what is in the APT1 report. But there are some other things I think that should be paid attention to. You know, for me personally, I know that a lot of people have read the APT1 report and, for instance, really go to the assumption that, you know, the new hotness, the new threat vector to pay attention to is spear phishing. And certainly, I think we can all agree that spear phishing is definitely a risk, but to say that is where we need to pay attention at the detriment of other things is really a bad idea. So if you read the Mandiant report, in my view, they do a good job of balancing out some of the other threats. So in the report, they go through a couple of key attack strategies and then go into a couple of examples of each. So their first point is that attackers, especially advanced attackers, are increasingly attacking outsourced service providers of their intended targets, or even business partners of their intended targets, because oftentimes it's very difficult, especially given certain types of industries like defense, to actually penetrate into that network, onto those computers. But if you're able to leverage an outsourced provider who might have, you know, one, network access to your intended target, and two, weaker controls, it provides an avenue into your victim's systems. And so their point there is that while you may have really good processes and procedures and policies and technology and monitoring solutions, but if your vendors, if the people who attach to your network aren't at a consistent level of security and discipline, you're still exposed. So it's kind of the old adage that the strength of the chain depends on the strength of the weakest link. The problem is that most people don't realize they have these weak links laying around until it's too late. And their next point is that attackers are getting into networks and then looking for information about the network or the company or the environment. So they're really doing pretty thorough reconnaissance. And Mandiant's suggestion there is to make sure you properly secure things like network diagrams and security strategies and org charts, things that would enable attackers to actually move around more easily and target different people in different ways. And next is that victims of persistent attacks tend to be victims again. And basically, if you as a entity fall victim to an advanced attacker like those that they claim to see, just because you've gotten them out of your network doesn't mean that's the end of the story. And what their point is that they often see continued attacks and attempts by both that same group that was on their inside the network before, but also other groups. So you can use your imagination how that might happen. If, for instance, APT1 doesn't work, maybe APT2's strategies will be more effective. And then their last point is that spear phishing is not the only tool that these advanced attackers are using. They're also using what we commonly call watering hole attacks. So basically figuring out what kinds of websites the employees of the targeted entity visit, and then going off and attacking one of those sites and having it host some kind of exploit code so that people in the victim organization can get infected. And there's a lot of sophistication that can go into these things, so that, for instance, you may compromise a very large site, like, let's say, NBC.com. But you only trigger the actual exploit if a certain profile of person happens to go to that site. So you may only have that exploit trigger if it's coming from a specific company's domain. So you might recognize that workstations that work for a specific defense contractor have a certain domain name when they do a reverse lookup on DNS, or they may come from a specific IP address range. And once the intended victims are there, some zero-day vulnerability is exploited, and that's used to drop the malware onto the target system. And this works very similar to the non-advanced, in quotes, attacks that we have been seeing to drop some of the more mundane criminal mischief, banking Trojan-type malware. So Maniac goes on to give three examples. I would say the more interesting example is the second example, which describes a company who is persistently attacked through a couple of different business partners. And once one business partner gets cleaned up, the other one is now providing a vector for the attackers to get back into their network. And so both IT outsourcers and those who outsource their IT need to be particularly mindful about this. In any event, I thought this report was actually really good. There's a link to it in the show notes. I think if you go to www.mandiant.com, you can find it somewhere under their news section if you don't want to go digging through the show notes. And the last story before I pass out has to do with another report. This one is actually the first release of a company that I hadn't heard of before called Solutionary. Solutionary appears to be a managed security service provider. And their report's pretty long. I think there's a lot of rehashed ground in here, but there are a couple of interesting things that I think are worth talking about here. And primarily, it's with their key findings. So I just want to read through those and maybe talk about a few. First one is that DDoS and malware infection recovery is costing organizations thousands of dollars per day. I don't think that's very surprising to anybody. Hopefully, most people who are in a profile of business where DDoS is either going to interrupt your business or you are likely to become a victim of DDoS, you really need to be working with your provider on some kind of a mitigation strategy. And I think if you do that, you end up incurring a lot less cost here. The next one is actually a little surprising, maybe, and that's that U.S. IP addresses are the largest source of attacks against U.S. organizations. It's probably not quite as controversial as it sounds. In the report, they do point out that this is probably more related to people in foreign countries compromising U.S.-based systems and using that to attack the systems locally. And that has a lot of advantages. It lets you bypass things like IP reputation and other very basic blocking type of situations where potentially a certain country's IP address range is filtered from the target entity. Also, it makes attribution much more obscure, right? So you don't know that the attack is coming from Russia or the Ukraine or France or China or what have you. All you see is that an Amazon Web Service instance is attacking you, or some mail server somewhere is trying to exfiltrate data to a location in the U.S. And that's really as far as you can track it by yourself. All right, their next finding is that attack techniques vary significantly by country of origin. And so basically, the French work a little different than China, and they work a little different than Japan, and so on and so on. And then kind of in the same vein, attackers from different countries focus on different industry targets. In the Mandiant report, APT1, there's a pretty clear association between the kinds of organizations being attacked and at least what is believed to be the Chinese imperatives for growth. And so this seems to slot into that whole argument that the attackers are probably going after strategic intellectual property that can help their local country. The next key finding is that distributed denial service attacks are being used to divert attention from more serious breaches. And we talked about an instance of that last week with the Bank of the West being DDoSed, and then that was hiding some fraudulent transactions, and the people who were victimized actually couldn't get online and check their account. Next is that 76% of DDoS attacks target SSL protected components of web applications. I don't think there's a lot of surprise there, especially as more and more web applications are only accessible through SSL. All right, next key finding is that attacker distribution in DDoS makes certain defenses ineffective. And again, coming from many thousands of addresses, if you're able to spread those across geographies and industries and some cable modems, some DSL lines, some businesses, it becomes much harder to definitively block out the source of the problem. All right, their next finding is that malware attacks target the financial and retail verticals. They claim that 80% of attempts they see to infect organizations with malware are directed at either financial or retail clients. And usually that's in the form of phishing or spam with a little added extra. Next key finding is that 54% of malware evades antivirus detection. Oh, this is such a painful one. I'm not even sure I want to talk about it here. Sometimes we hear it's 50%, sometimes we hear it's 2%, sometimes it's much higher. Especially in targeted cases, it's probably going to be very, very low because, again, if you are an attacker trying to get into somebody's environment, you're going to try your malware against whatever they're using first, so you know that it gets in. And I'd also say that their testing mechanism of using VirusTotal, I think, has been pretty thoroughly debunked by actually VirusTotal themselves. It's just not a good strategy, because you're really only statically analyzing the files, whereas most of the antivirus vendors will tell you that static analysis is only part of their protocol. They also do heuristics as the programs are running, and so you would expect to see the detection rate slightly better. But, you know, not everybody has a big malware lab where they can spool up pieces of malware and watch them run and see all these different antivirus engines actually working in real time. All right, the next key finding, which is no surprise to anyone, is that Java is the most targeted software in exploit kits. Enough said. Next is that older vulnerabilities still are being attacked by exploit kits. And this comes up a time and time again, that we see these exploit kits using, you know, 2-3 sometimes year old exploits. And the reason they do that is that it generally works. Not all attackers have the ability to come up with their own brand new zero day. And so you may as well go with what works, because apparently we as a whole can't patch our stuff. All right, the next key finding is that web application attacks target the retail vertical. And again, not terribly surprising. Web application attacks typically take the form of SQLi. And again, they're typically looking for credit cards. They want to get to some kind of monetization. So they're looking for credit cards. And it is often pretty effective to try some SQLi against retail websites. And maybe you get lucky and you get a table of credit card numbers. All right, next is that well-known web application attacks continue. I think that fits pretty well with the previous comment. Keep using what's still working, right? So anyway, the report's pretty interesting. Some places more interesting than others. It has lots of really very nice graphs. So the management types might get a lot out of it. It's about 73 pages long, so, you know, keep that in mind. I've got a link to the report in the show notes. You know, hey, give it a read. It's interesting stuff. Well, I think I'm going to call it a night before I fall over in my chair. I hope you all have a great week. Remember, if you have any feedback, any ideas, any stories, you hate my voice, whatever, give me an email, info@defensivesecurity.org, or hit me up on Twitter @defensivesec. And otherwise, I will talk to you all again next week.